Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, we're talking with Paul Pesic about his book about the politics of the development of the U.S. Navy in the Gilded Age and Progressive Era, entitled Congress Buys a Navy. Paul, welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
Fine.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling the listeners something about yourself.
Well, it's kind of a long story because I'm an old guy by now, but I started out with a Navy career. And I was commissioned back in 1961 and became a Navy pilot. And I spent most of my career flying on aircraft carriers. Eventually, I flew jets. I served in Vietnam for 13 months from, 1966 to 67. But primarily, I was a carrier pilot. And I went through the ranks, and I ended up by commanding a squadron of S-3 jet planes, and then had carrier duty. I was operations officer on a nuclear carrier, and then the navigator on the Dwight D. Eisenhower. And then I went to Europe for 3 years, and I was a NATO chief of staff in Naples, in the southern region, where we did the anti-submarine warfare for the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. And then I came back home to Florida, where I commanded Naval Air Station Whiting Field. And then finally, my last tour was at the Naval War College, where I held the Stephen B. Luce Chair of Naval Strategy. And so that's my Navy career. But when I ended the Navy career, my friends at the War College really enjoyed introducing me to scholarship. And they said that I like scholarship, and they recommended that I go on to get an advanced degree. I already had a bachelor's degree in philosophy from Holy Cross College, and I had a master of strategic studies at University in Newport. So it's pretty true, but it didn't work out. Stony Brook, you got that one. Stony Brook was a little bit more fussy than that. They said, "Well, you have scholarship behind you, but you've never studied history." I said, "Oh boy, okay." So I said, "You have to start with your master's degree." So if you can imagine this 52-year-old retired Navy captain showing up where there were more women than men in the class, and they were small classes. There were like 10 to 12 people in the classes. And these were, when I say women, these were women from the so-called Seven Sisters, which don't exist anymore, but like Smith College and really high-level scholars. So I learned a lot from them. And, of course, as the master's level, it was pretty much reading for a year and a half. They advertised that you could finish in a year, but I never knew anybody who could do it in a year who could do all that reading. So a year and a half, and then I got into the doctorate program, and I started studying the Navy because I was interested in Stephen B. Luce and Admiral Alpha Thayer Mahan, who I had studied and taught when I was at the Navy War College. And from those guys, I realized that not that they weren't in charge, but they were somewhat exaggerated. I occasionally get criticized for this. It's like I don't like those guys, and that's not true. They were terrific, but they didn't have as much voice in actually creating the Navy as I thought. Now, Luce was my hero because he was the one who really started enlisted Navy training. actually stopped whipping, if you can imagine that, when we went from sail to steam. He said that we're not going to use cat nine tails anymore. And then they established ships, which were receiving ships for sailors, instead of just putting them on a ship and go learn how to sail. So he was very, he was noted for that. That was a great contribution, which people really don't look at. Now, I didn't put very much of that in the book because it really wasn't what I was dealing with. But I saw that he was really an instrumental guy. He was the one that secretaries of the Navy would send on special missions to find out if the shipyard was efficient and things like that. And then by the time of the Civil War, he was in charge of the fleet training for enlisted guys. Now, Mahan was different. Luce was a midshipman at the age of 14. Mahan was a very late bloomer. He started the midshipman around the age of 19. Luce's career is amazing because he was a midshipman in New York, and then his first deployment was 3 years. So he's a kid. He turns 15, 16, 17. He does Europe. He comes back home for a while. Not too long, then he gets on another ship and goes around South America, goes to Japan, the first U.S. Navy warship in Japan, and Luce is still a kid on that. And I wrote a little bit about that in the book just to capture the concept that these naval officers were not the aristocrats that they're sometimes accused of being. Yes, their families were aristocratic. Luce's family, I think, came over on a Mayflower or something like that. And he had a personal interview with the president when he was 14. But you can't take the fact away that this guy spent 3 years here, 3 years there, came back in another two-year deployment. These guys were sailors. And what did they do? They learned their scholarship at sea. They lived in the lowest deck. It's called the Orlop deck, all the way at the bottom of the ship. And they had books, and they read, and they learned. And they didn't become officers for sometimes like 10 years or something like that. They were in their mid to late 20s by the time they became officers. So all of a sudden, they had tremendous respect to these because there was no communication. I mean, you know, when you're in Japan in 1860, you know, you come back a couple of months later and tell them what you did. That's the way it worked. So they were very independent, which has been a fault of the Navy, which I think is a great fault. The naval officers at sea make their own decisions. So having said all that, now I'm thinking about who built the Navy. So I'm focusing on those guys. And I started with biographies, which to really absorb a biography takes a lot of time, as you probably know. And there were a lot of books written about it, but I started with the Library of Congress. And that's when I was introduced into the concept of how many feet of information it was on a particular person. Like Mahan, I don't remember how many feet it was, like 6 or 7 feet of records or something like that. So that was my start with naval officers. Then when I started looking at what they did, I realized that Secretary of the Navy's were important. And then I started doing the bios of them, and that found me in museums, I mean, in libraries all over the place. One of my most interesting library experiences was in Bowdoin College up in Maine, and I was looking at Speaker of the House Thomas Reed, and this was a very formal library. You know, you take your jacket off, and all you can have is a piece of paper with a hole in it so that you know what it is, and you're allowed pencils to go in there, and I'm sitting at the table, and the nice librarian brings out records from Thomas Reed, and they're written in French because he practices French language when he was writing his stuff. And that was a lot of fun. Right? You know, so these were the encounters. And then my next step, after I read the both biographies and read the correspondence, then I moved over to from the Library of Congress to the Legislative Affairs of the Library of Congress. And the Legislative Affairs branch department is kind of new. It's probably from the 60s or 70s, and it was a small branch, and now it's devoted to Legislative Affairs. And those guys were really great. That's where I did the bulk of my intellectual thinking. The other stuff was simply gathering. And that's when I got to look at the committee records. And this is something that, as historians, we try to find out everything we can about it. And that's where I found out everything I could. Those were living documents for me. When I could actually read not just a congressional record, which is always available in major libraries, but the committee records, and to see what their arguments were. And some of them were pretty specious. You read these things, I can't believe that was their argument. But the setup, when I started kind of deciding, I didn't decide on the end date, but I decided on a beginning date. I decided that I'd start with Garfield, because he was an interesting guy. He picked a Secretary of the Navy out of the blue simply to reward him for being a Republican. He was a Southerner New Orleans, and his background was Northern universities where he didn't like slavery, so he's down in New Orleans now, and he doesn't like slavery, he doesn't like the war, and all that sort of stuff. So after the war, the Republicans don't like him, the Southern Republicans, of course, and he's a lawyer, and eventually he wins the position of being the head lawyer in New Orleans, but it doesn't work because that's when the first really well-known time when they decide what what we did with Bush some years ago. It was kind of a recount, and they decided that the three states, so I guess it was Florida, Louisiana, and I forget the third state. South Carolina had false records, and they sent the Congress down there, and this guy ended up by not getting the position, so they felt sorry for him, sent him to New York, sent him to Washington to make him Secretary of the Navy eventually because he lost his power in Louisiana. And I'm thinking that this is...
That actually gets to one of the points that you make about the Secretaries of the Navy during the early part of your book, which is that it's a cabinet-level position. It's sort of equivalent today to the Secretary of Defense. And yet at the same time, it is not really the most important position. So oftentimes it serves as a way of satisfying various political ambitions or checking off certain political boxes, and not so much about choosing someone who, say, has a vast knowledge or experience with the Navy.
That's exactly right. In fact, that's even more... firmer than you said, because it was absolutely a reward, and it was also the lowest of all the cabinet members. It was the least important one. I mean, when he took over, what, they have like 30 something ships, and I think there was five or six of them that were iron. The rest were all wooden, and he didn't know anything about the Navy. I do mention it in the book a little bit, and I didn't want to do too much with it because that takes the Navy back to the aristocracy. But he was wealthy, a wealthy lawyer from New Orleans, and he joined a club in Washington, D.C., and that's where he met these senior naval officers, the so-called aristocracy, came from wealthy families, so like the Cosmo Club, that sort of thing. That wasn't the one it was, but that's the concept. So, yeah, there is a nexus between how the Secretary of Navy gets elected and how he meets his senior staff, which is not very encouraging because they say, gee, is that how it works? And of course, it's not how it works, but that's how it appears sometimes. It's just a bunch of aristocrats. In fact, there is a book written about, the name of it is called The Naval Aristocracy by Peter Karsten. And he spends his whole time doing that. I'm not too sure what his intent is, if he's just trying to kind of make fun of us or what, but with all my sea experience, I can say we were not aristocrats. That's for sure. We were out at sea. That's the furthest thing from our minds.
I was wondering if you could elaborate upon one of the points you just made and provide a bit of context for the listeners about the status of the Navy immediately after the Civil War. Because one of the things that struck me is that you really highlight at the beginning of the book what is something of an odd contrast, which is that we have this great seafaring tradition going back, naval history tradition going back to John Paul Jones in the American Revolution. And then you have, Oliver Hazard Perry in the War of 1812. And yet you would think that there would be a lot invested in the Navy. And yet you describe that even after the Civil War, which had this unprecedented buildup, that the Navy is not exactly a leading fighting force at that time that you start the book.
Well, part of the problem, or whatever it is, it's a matter of the way we fight. I use the term guerre de corps and guerre d'escadre, which are French words. And the war, of course, basically means a commercial war. And that's the wars that we fought until the Spanish-American War. And we were totally outnumbered by Great Britain, so the Navy's job, the spunky old Navy is what they called it, would try to sink all the commercial ships, and that's what we did. In fact, somewhere along the line, I think it was in the 1830s when we ruined the British whaling trade by going out and sinking all the whalers. You know, those are not big issues, but the Navy itself had this job of going around and sinking commercial ships. The problem was at the end of the Civil War, the Navy wasn't disbanded, but they were certainly reduced. And I think I mentioned this, but it might not be understood by the public, that the Army at the time of the Civil War was basically a reserve army. It was a temporary army. They were either drafted or volunteered, and most of the the colonels and majors and all those guys couldn't wait to get back to their profession. Where the Navy requires a significant number of years to learn seamanship. So they were regular officers, and regular officers can't get fired. they can resign or they can have a crappy job. So what happened, they have all these regular officers, and the ships are in decline, and they're not making any more ships. So it is true that by 1880 there was a glut of naval officers who weren't getting their sea time. So then Congress jumps in and says, if they don't get their sea time, they don't get promoted. So this is how the period starts. It was not in total neglect, but they didn't have any plan by 1881 when Garfield took over. And the first the Secretary of Navy at the time was not that kind of a hard charger. By this time, Luce was an admiral, and Luce was clamoring for ships, and he wanted to change the Navy organization of cabinets. He says it's corrupt. It's the Congress. It's in Congress's pocket.
Could you explain that organization a bit? Because it really is an important part of the book itself. You discuss it throughout every chapter because it remains in place throughout most of the period that you're covering.
It remains in place till 1940s. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I don't know if you realize that. It wasn't until after World War II that that they were disbanded, that the departments were disbanded. When I joined the Navy, it was 1961, I had a life preserver that said Bureau Air on it, Bureau of Aeronautics. They had already been disbanded, but some of the stuff still had the Bureau Air model or mode on the back of it. And what this meant was the bureaus were founded before the Civil War, and they were altered a little bit during the Civil War, but they answered directly to Congress. Now, this is kind of a strange situation that started from the 1830s, where they figured that the Navy was more complicated than the Army, and it had bureaus. And the number varied, but it was generally about 8 by the time I was writing. And the most important bureau was the so-called Bureau of Navigation. And that guy was in charge of operating. Even though he was not the senior, he was generally the most, you know, important one. So the bureaus got their funding from Congress. And this was a strange situation. I'm sure there are other ones, industrial ones, but for the Navy, having 8 bureaus who answered to Congress, not the Secretary of the Navy or the President. And their funding was by congressional line items. And that gets a little bit confusing. What's a line item? It means that the Congress decides to give the Bureau of Yards and Docks X number of dollars per year. It doesn't decide to give the Navy a total number of dollars for the Navy to divvy it up. It specifies this actual total amount in millions of dollars per session as to what they're going to give to each bureau. And the bureaus went from navigation to yards and docks to all the way down to medical and supply. There were 8 of them. Personnel was in the navigation department. So this system was unique, and this system really had a nexus with Congress that the other services didn't have. So throughout the entire period, they are essentially answering to Congress, even though they are answering to the head of the Navy. We don't have a chief of naval operations at the time until much later, until World War One. So there is no single head. There's no single officer head of the Navy. And that's, to me, that's a really interesting concept, because how can you run a military organization without having a head? You know, the Army always had a commanding general or something like that. So the Navy had no head. The head was the admiral in charge of the Navigation Bureau, who decided on the deployments and the training and stuff like that. But he did not rule over the other seven bureau chiefs. Supposedly, the Secretary of the Navy did, which was his job to do that. But in reality, it was the Congress who really controlled the eight bureaus. And throughout the entire period of my book, and then in various periods up until post-World War II, when it just got so big they decided to disband the navies, I mean the navies bureaus. So if you can imagine this organization, dysfunctional is not an exact word, but it comes to mind, you know. Is it really dysfunctional? Well, yeah, because the Congress has too much authority. Is that a good thing to say? Well, that's their job to have authority, you know. And Congress, of course, will not have any, they won't listen to anything about disbanding the bureaus. They don't do that until the 1940s. Well, obviously not, you know, because each guy has his own a little patch that he's interested in. So that's the situation that I started with, and it took me a while to figure out that in Congress there were guys who were, of course, posturing when you're reading the congressional record, but when you're looking at the committees, you realize that they're dealing with self-interests. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you say, well, is that bad or is that good? And some of the self-interests are natural. I mean, the 1881, the South wanted ships in southern ports. That was their 100% goal. They didn't care what they were. And they wanted iron ships because of a crazy reason that iron ships rust faster than steel ships. So the iron ships go into freshwater rivers, and the South has a bunch of freshwater rivers. And what the South wants is independence and nothing to do with the North. And their solution, this is congressional solutions, is to get ships. And throughout the period, the South has a pretty good-sized voice. The voice of the Northern industrialists, congressional now, is that they want the ship building to be in the North. So it's almost as if there's a trade-off. The South wants the ports, and the North wants to build the ships. And as early as the 1880s, the West Coast is already afraid of Japan. So they want ships in Japan. It takes from 1880 to 1914 to get a canal, right? To get the canal to finish 1914. Mm-hmm. And they keep on getting a promise. Yeah, we're going to build a canal. We'll send the ships around. You can imagine how, you know, you're in California, and if you want a ship, how long is it going to take to steam from Norfolk to San Francisco by going around? So they want shipbuilding on the West Coast, and they're not particularly interested in arguing whether it's going to be government shipbuilding or commercial shipbuilding. They just want ships. And, of course, the majority of the Midwest and Southern Midwest doesn't want a Navy at all. So, mm-hmm, yeah. So that's what you're faced with, you know, and that's what it looks like. That's almost consistent throughout the period, although towards the turn of the century, by the time we get into the Spanish-American War, the South is no longer wedded to the idea of ports, but they become wedded to the idea of government-owned shipbuilding, and that becomes the next argument because they want the industry in the South. At first, they just want the ships, and then they want the industry. So that's a major battle, and that is actually Republicans versus Democrats, and the Democrats finally take over, the Southern Democrats, of course, during the Wilson administration, when there's a big movement for government shipbuilding. And, of course, the Republicans and the Northern guys say, this is expensive because if we have government shipyard, what are we going to do? Hire and fire, hire and fire? Well, the commercial guys, he's got some kind of a postal ship next to him and a cruiser next to him and stuff like that. And that's what they do. They ebb and flow. Mm-hmm. But if the government's going to do its own shipbuilding, then it's going to be much more expensive. Then that becomes the argument that, no, we can do it cheaper, and we can't do it cheaper. That goes on way past my period. It's probably still going on. I don't really know about shipbuilding now. I know the nuclear ships that I was built in Newport News by a civilian operation.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in the book the issue, for example, with armor plating, and I thought that was a good way of getting to the issue in a more focused way, which was that you had this transition taking place from wood to iron, which was well underway when you start the book, and then you're going from iron to steel, and
right.
How there's this question about how much it costs per ton of iron plate, and you get offers from Carnegie Steel and I think the other one was Bethlehem, and they're proposing that it's going to cost them a minimum of, say, $500 per ton. And as you point out in the book, there are various special ways of preparing the metal, which the steel, which drives the cost. And the attitude in Congress, which, you know, localism aside, is about, you know, basically reducing expenditures, they feel that this is outrageous.
Well, it's actually, that's a very good point, but it's more than that. It's not just as outrageous. They see their contemporary industrial leaders cheating. Whether it's cheating or not, I don't know. I mean, I kind of do know in some cases it was. But what they see is that these guys overcharging to make money, and that's what Congress wants to stop. They're not as much worried about quality, or they worry about it sometime. And also, if you remember, which I don't cover it very well, is that's a period of time when steel is really being developed. You know, it goes from iron to steel. So we have some congressmen who have the steelmakers in their district who think it's very good. And they are the minority. The majority of Congress decides that the industry is charging them too much, $500, $400, $300. So Congress will arbitrarily set a price. And it was $300 for quite a while. So what happened is, especially with the cruisers, they didn't get built. Mm-hmm. They stayed in the yards, and they waited a year or two to get armor. So that was a pretty significant action. And then the next problem, which I only talk about a little bit, is they put the armor in the wrong place. This was the Navy's fault. So the ship looked wonderful until they loaded it up, and then it sunk. I mean, it didn't sink, so you couldn't do it, but it went lower in the water. The water line went down, which meant that the armor was now below the water line, which didn't do any good. You want your armor at the water line and above. So that was another big problem that the Navy had. And that one was, I think, the Navy's fault. But the arguments about the armor were real, and they were long-term, and we sent Navy guys over to Europe, to France, and to England to see what kind of armor steel they used and how much they paid and that sort of stuff. And that went on and on all the way into the 1900s about what kind of steel and how much to do it and are they making too much money on us. And Congress, I hesitate to say this, but I think Congress was almost a decent watchdog on that particular one. But there were some guys like Reed who just didn't want big ships. So he was anti-armor, period, because he didn't need them. That's what that they said. So those guys were obstructionist, and those were the guys who were dominant, who kept the price at $300 a ton and caused a fair amount of pre-Spanish-American War ships to be delayed by a couple of years. That was a pretty interesting operation. But also, in keeping in the book, doesn't that show that Congress buys the Navy? I mean, to me, that's perfect example. You know, there's money, and they buy it, and it's their money. And whatever the Navy wants is not going to be the end result. So they're actually delayed. So there you go.
And that money issue becomes even more important given the technological transformation that's taking place, not just the transition from wood to iron to steel, but also the innovations in gunnery. You have technologies like the sub the submersible, the submarine, which are being developed during the period you're covering. And that's a consideration, a concern for several naval officers, but Congress is never really considering that this technology is changing, and this technology, when it, as it's changing, is not leading to cheaper ships, but more expensive ones.
It never does. Yeah, you got that right. And the technology, and if you really think about it, I don't know if there's a comparable technology with aviation, because aviation, although those planes are super, there's a lot less technology in an airplane than there is in an aircraft carrier, or I should say a battleship, because my period is battleships. You know, when you have the ships, just to give you some numbers, the World War II destroyers maybe had a crew of 180 or something like that. My squadron, with 10 aircraft aboard the John F. Kennedy, had 220 men. That's one squadron. We had 10 squadrons on the aircraft carrier, and that's not counting the crew that runs the carrier. On the Eisenhower, we had 6,000 men on it. So that's a tremendous leap in technology that was occurring starting in the 1880s. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing here is that the sailing ships had twice as many or three times as many sailors on it as the Steel Navy did. I don't know if you caught that in the book or if you even noticed it. Well, when I talked about Luce and Mahan being midshipmen, mm-hmm. because they had guys whose sole job was to climb up in one spot in one place in the rigging and adjust that line. And they might have as many as 100 sailors up in the rigging at the same time. So when they switched over to the Steel Navy without sails, the manning level went down. But, of course, the technology went up. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you caught this because you read it, but the first three ships, the ABCs, actually four, the Atlantic, Boston, Chicago, and
Dolphin.
Dolphin. They also had to have sails. The Congress required that. The Navy didn't want that. The Congress had to have sails just in case. And because the Civil War model was, even if they had those basic engines, sometimes with paddle wheels and some with screw propellers, they would not use them all the time. They would sail because they would save on the coal and that sort of thing. But then later on, up until the ABCDs, they said, well, we still need to have sails. I didn't cover this in the book, but Mahan got in a lot of trouble for that when he was a captain of the Chicago. He was in Europe, and he was getting accolades for his 1890 book by the British. They all thought it was wonderful, you know, sea power and world and all that sort of stuff. And the admiral on the ship really, truly disliked Mahan. Well, how do you get along if the admiral doesn't like you when you're the commanding officer of a ship? So Mahan got a bad fitness report because he didn't know how to sail. Well, that's what the admiral said. So Mahan got all upset and did it. He said, "I'll show you," and he did it, and it was successful. But boy, I tell you, that crew must have been hard worked. I would not have wanted to have been on that ship when you got that kind of conflict on the bridge, and then you have to go do something that you've never done before to prove that you can sail. And that's the last incident that I know that it became a big issue, and then they took the sails down. But you can see that transition, and what has Congress got to do with that, you know? how do they care whether you can sail it or not? So I don't think they did. I think they let the Navy do that. Congress was money, you know, and that's, is it functional? Is it money? And I think that the technology issue, the gunnery issue, was another big one. And this was something that we were learning about. Do you have a way for sparks to go down into your ship and blow up all the powder that's down there? What kind of breaches do you have, and how do you get the gunpowder up to the level of the shooting area? So those are the things that the Navy was doing, and I mentioned it one time when there was a big fight between two magazines, of all things. This was in the 1890s when one magazine was taking the part of the anti-Navy, saying that the ships were no good. They were sinking because they had too much iron on them and they were improperly built. And then the other magazine says, no, everything's great. And then they counterpart. They went for about, four or five issues on this. And, I didn't know anything about it until I started. And then I said, I got to find out these two magazines, noted magazines who were talking about the Navy in the 1890s, this argument about, whether they were good or bad. And as it turned out, we never really had any disasters, so I guess I could end up by saying they were good. And did Congress have anything to do with this? Yes, in that they were saying, well, we don't want that type of ship. But the armor was the thing, and then the gunnery. But that was the money thing. The other part was the Navy contractors, and then that became an argument of whether they were civilian or government contractors. But you really hit the nail on the head, and that armor, as far as I know, lasted probably up until World War II, and thereafter we stopped putting armor on the ships. But how are you going to get a big bullet to bounce off it? You know, that's shooting each other now 10 miles apart and stuff like that. So, yeah, that was a big issue.
One of the other aspects of naval development that you discuss in your book is foreign policy, because at the same time as you're seeing this technological transition that you cover, there's also a growing engagement with the world, which changes some of the dynamics involving naval policy and the role of the Navy. Whereas prior to the 1880s, 1890s, there was not necessarily much of a constant requirement to have a large naval presence globally. This begins to change with the growing interest in Hawaii, the growing interest in what's happening in Asia, and then of course you have the Spanish-American War. And you also, as part of that, you this is where you tie it into the Harrison administration, Benjamin Harrison's administration, and the figure of Benjamin Tracy. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to what was happening there in the 1890s and how that also places certain imperatives upon Congress to develop the Navy and grow the Navy.
Well, the foreign affairs is developmental, as you know, and the Hawaii case is probably central, although I do talk about it. It was the Boston, which was the second of the new ships from the 1880s, that went to Hawaii. So what business do we have doing, and what are we doing in Hawaii? Okay, well, the Americans, or the expatriate Americans, or whatever you call them, they're Hawaiians. They've been there for a generation. We all know about missionaries going to Hawaii before the Civil War, but by the time of the rise of the new Navy, ex-Americans now take over the Hawaiian Islands. They basically arrest all the Hawaiian people and they kick out the Queen and all that sort of stuff. And the Boston is there, and the ambassador calls the Boston in to send the army. At that time, the cruisers always carried the armed forces with them, a couple of hundred. So they come ashore to take over Hawaii, and that becomes an issue until the Spanish-American War as to what are we going to do with Hawaii. And once again, Congress is involved in this. Some congressmen think that it's a good idea. Remember, up until the Spanish-American War, the United States has never annexed anybody. We just haven't done that. So the forces are ashore there, and we're trying to take over the government, and that's during the Harrison, at the end of the Harrison administration, when it starts, and that continues on until the Spanish-American War, when we annex Hawaii after we declare war on Spain. But the Tracy case is interesting because he's a funny guy, and I don't know how to handle him. I don't know if he's a phony, a fake, or unfortunate, or really good at it. Of all the people who get elected as the father of the new Navy, he seems to be one of the more dominant ones. And I know you read it, and there's a lot of guys, you know, who get credit for being the start of the new Navy. Tracy does the most for the beginning of the new Navy. He himself, a fascinating guy, a lawyer, and we don't know if he had heart trouble or PTS or whatever it was, postmaster, but he had an awful Civil War experience. He was given a commission because of his being a lawyer and all that sort of stuff. When he got into combat, he only lasted about 2 days, and he had heart troubles, is what they said. And then he went back in twice, and they finally relieved him and sent him back up to New York to run one of the Confederate prison camps. And he, by now he was so wealthy that he took like a year off to go to Europe. And so this is a really fascinating background for a guy that Harrison picks for his Secretary of the Navy. He's very a real political guy, and apparently really smart. And he really starts building the Navy. However, my not a criticism, but stating what he's doing, once again, he is running it himself. So now we have the legislative branch. We have the Secretary of the Navy deciding what the senior officers should do in the Navy. So it's not a happy match. But he is a very good voice in Congress, and he does make changes. He gets changes made, and he gets good shipbuilding. Tragedy is when his house gets on fire. His house cost about four times more than his annual salary. How about that? His house in Washington. And the way he paid for it was he had all his racing, his trotters. He used all the trotters in New York State, you know, big racing. He owned a lot of horses, and he sold several of them to get $40,000 to build his Washington mansion. And then it caught on fire, and his wife died. So after his wife died, he went to the White House, and Harrison took him in. They lived together for a while. So Harrison is a case that kind of, is he likable or is he unlikable? Is he good for the Navy? We find out later on that he was philandering with his niece, and after Harrison's wife died, he married his niece and had a couple of kids by her after he left the White House. So I said, what is this? Yeah, what's happening here, you know? But he and Tracy, and Harrison, is for students of history, people probably recognize this, that he was probably one of the most active presidents after the Civil War. He had the most legislation, I think, of everybody. But he's also responsible for Wounded Knee and all that other stuff. So he has a very spotty record there. But he actually becomes the guy that looks like he's building the new Navy. He really does. And I don't like to jump on him too much for his so-called peccadilloes, but I think that Tracy had the right idea. He really wanted to once again break up the bureaus. That was one of the things Tracy tried to do. And there's no way. I mean, every Secretary of Navy, whether he was strong or weak, that's the very first thing they said, you know, this is wrong. It's not working right. They want to break up the Navy. They made some changes to it, but they couldn't get rid of the 8 bureaus. So, I guess you think that you see Tracy as being the father of the Navy, or when you're reading, or do you think he's just one of the good guys?
I see him really not in that sense, but just more that the way you present it in the book is that there's a turning point in the late 1880s and early 1890s. And it really is that at that point, it's, in a way, it's of a piece of the broader activism of the Harrison administration. But you also have with Tracy and a more of a determined effort to build up the Navy, and coupled with what the Harrison administration is doing with Hawaii, which when Cleveland returns to the presidency, his administration tries to undo. But you do see both the development of a Navy and the development of a greater need for the Navy. And so when McKinley comes in your book, you have a Navy that goes to war in 1898, and it's in a way, it's Tracy's Navy. It's the ships that they ordered. It's the ball that they got rolling in the late 1880s and early 1890s. Because when McKinley, when you have John Long and Theodore Roosevelt in your book, talking about building up the Navy, those ships aren't going to be ready in 1898. They're going to be ready in 1899. They're going to be ready in 1900. They're in essence, that becomes the core of the Great White Fleet.
Yeah, well, that's exactly how I saw it, because you look at McKinley and you try to see the flow of Cleveland's second administration, which I thought very interesting because that was a real financial problem. Cleveland inherited that. But yet he kept on building out the Navy that McKinley started. I mean, that Harrison started. So there was continuity there. And I can't get into Cleveland's head, but Harrison definitely started that. And I don't know if I would call that imperialism, but he certainly was interested in outside the United States business and that sort of stuff. That's, you know, that's clear about his actions and his all his stuff. So when after with the Hawaii incident or whatever we call it, it was clearly a problem with the United States, and that's when the Navy had a voice saying that, hey, our ships are slower than postal ships, than the regular post office ships that are sinking in the ocean. How can we do guerre de corps when we can't even catch them? You know? Yeah. That's what happens. I mean, that's how I see the Harrison guys, but he doesn't get the fair ships. It's the next administration that gets it, but that's where it starts, because they say, if we are going to seek out an enemy, we got to be faster than the enemy. So that's when you have the race to be faster. Well, that's true. How can you chase somebody and be slower than them? You know, the old age of sail, there was all different things on how much canvas you put out and everything else. And now we're talking about weight and engines and gunpowder. And we did it. You know, clearly we did it by the time of the Spanish-American War. And how we got into that, even today it's argued. I don't have any big problem with who blew up the Maine. I don't know if you're aware of this, but Admiral Rickover was the one who did the final examination of the Maine. Did you know? Are you aware of that?
Mm-hmm. It was the 1970s, wasn't it? Right.
That's one of the kind of last things he did. So at the point of the Spanish McKinley had been at war in the Civil War. Okay, he was a junior soldier. And he didn't like war. I mean, he said, I've been there, you know. And boy, do I think of that with my Vietnam experience. I said, yeah, by the way, I've actually experienced war, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's not much fun, you know. It's not wonderful and everything. So McKinley was very guarded about that. And he said, let's make sure that the Maine was not blown up by ourselves, which we pretty much conclude that it was. And the interesting thing there is for McKinley to show that he didn't want to start war. I mention in the book, but maybe it's not thought about, that the enlisted men could not go ashore. He didn't want any trouble. He didn't want any fighting or anything like that. And they were there for about three weeks or four weeks, and the guys, there was no shore leave. Only the officers could go ashore. So that shows McKinley doesn't want to aggravate the Spanish. And about 7 or 8 months before the Spanish-American War starts, they have another change of government and all that sort of stuff. And it looks like they're going to be friendly with us, but guarded. So McKinley is accepting that. And the Spanish army is not. The Spanish army is still beating the heck out of all the peasants in Cuba. So that's why we're there. We're trying to do something. The ship blows up. Then what do? You can't ignore it, of course. And just try to have an examination. And naturally, at this point, Congress, which very typical of Congress, they're going to be up in arms, right? Because they're the ones that work with the people. They're working directly with the people. So the majority of Congress says, we have to retaliate. And McKinley takes a couple of months to actually declare war. He actually says, it sounds almost the same that George W. Bush did in the Gulf War. If you think of the similarity there, where the United States was first going to go and beat him up in Iraq, and then the next thing, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says, hey, Mr. President, we ought to go to the UN to get the UN approval of this instead of just going attacking Iraq right now. And if you recall, we waited about two or three months in that period before we finally did the Iraq War. Well, McKinley's doing the same thing. He's trying to soften it. He says, let's make sure we have all our stuff together, make sure we have the right people there. We didn't have the diplomacy problem that that George Bush had with the UN, but it was almost a similar situation where McKinley decided, yes, he wrote down, we have to have these things. If these things occur, we have to go to war. And then they finally said a state of war exists, blah, blah, blah. And there's a little navalism in here that I always have to put in just for the record. I'm sure you're very familiar with Admiral Dewey down there in the Philippines. And do you know what his famous quote is? Do you remember that in your studies?
You may fire when ready, Gridley.
What's that all about?
It's about when he orders the ships to begin opening up on
the... He does not. The admiral cannot order the captain to do anything. The captain is the one who fires the ship. That's why that's so important. He says, you may fire when ready, Gridley. Think about that. That's what that's about. Gridley is the captain of the ship. He's the only one that can order his ship to fire when ready. How about that? A little bit of navalism, and I have to throw that in there. That's what that's all about. And my editor, a wonderful woman editor who did the final work on the book, and she was calling me a couple of times curiously. She said, now, you write that Dewey went into Manila, took over, wanted good story about how it did and how the battleships and the cruisers and everything won. And then the people in Manila wouldn't let him use the cable to communicate, so he cut the cable. And she says, isn't that cutting your nose off to spite your face or something like that? She was really, really... And I said, well, the way it worked is that the cable to Hong Kong came from New York across the Atlantic Ocean to England, a route all the way across to Hong Kong. And that's a pretty long stretch of cable. Mm-hmm. So our communication, Roosevelt's famous ready, you know, go be ready to go, went via the Atlantic. It didn't go via the Pacific because there was no Pacific cable for another 10 years or so. So if you think the communications through the British Embassy in Hong Kong, that's how we got our information. Dewey was an old-timer. He was an old Navy guy. And he does not need any direction from the United States to fight a war. That's Navy. I'll just fight my war here, you know. So I cut the cable. I don't need to talk to you guys. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to send a fast ship to Hong Kong back and forth every couple of days, and I'll tell you what I'm doing. That's kind of remarkable, you know. That's how we fought at that time, because there was no... The ship-to-shore communication was, even in World War I, it was iffy, but there was essentially none during the Spanish-American War. It was very difficult. You had to be very close in, and there wasn't very much airways. So that is, to me, the real change. The Spanish-American War, is the first modern war. Not quite, but it's the first modern war for us, because we were actually fighting ships. Now, I know it was the Spanish ships, and they weren't as good as ours and all that sort of stuff. That's true. But they were a navy that had cruisers capable of fighting with us. And if I was not a good American sailor, I'd almost feel sorry for them, you know, when they came across the Atlantic. And one thing I didn't cover, but I know this from history, that one of the ships was towed when they came across the Atlantic. And again, this is something that was historic. You might not be aware that until we had nuclear carriers, we had a requirement for aircraft carriers to be able to be capable of towing a ship. My first aircraft carrier was a World War II ship, the Wasp, but it was in its last days. And we used to have towing drills. So the Spanish had a destroyer that wasn't working, it lost its engine, so they towed it across, and that was common. Now, when you're towing a ship, of course, you're very vulnerable, naturally. So what the Spanish Guevara did was to go a bit south trying to get fuel. And when he finally could, they would only give him enough coal to go to Cuba. So he got to Cuba before we found out where he was. And he got in port in southern Cuba. So he's got his whole fleet in there. And our fleet comes out, and Roosevelt and those guys have their land fight. And all Guevara can do is to try to see if he can escape. He knows that he's bottled up. He knows that he can't. That there's no way that he's going to fight, so he gets all his guys in line of battle and steams out, and every single one of them gets sunk. It's a mm-hmm. tremendous victory for us, and it's the first true U.S. big war, big ships to ships. And they people would look at it again and look at the armament, they look at the gunnery and everything else, but the Spanish wasn't inferior. They didn't have the things we had. We had battleships and stuff like that. So now the battleship is it. Remember the Maine and the Texas were the first battleships, and then they were downgraded to cruisers, not the Maine because it was sunk, but the first Texas became a cruiser, and the second Texas was the second battleship. We renamed Texas, and that's the one that was World War One. World War One. So that I could see that as the movement to battleships because they worked. And they're big and expensive, but they worked. So that's the deal. And
the Spanish-American War does really seem to be the pivot point, because you have this interesting metric in your book where you periodically cite the comparisons that officers are making with the size of the U.S. Navy versus that of other fleets. And at the beginning of the 1880s, the United States Navy ranks at number 12, number 13. And then
which is really not even ranked.
By the time you get to the early 20th century, after the Spanish-American War, the United States is now, you're quoting these officers that are talking about how we're basically third behind just Britain and France. We're actually ahead of Germany during a period of time. And now it's less about building a navy and more about, you know, keeping up and maintaining a very different naval structure than the United States has ever had in its history.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. I mean, that's what happened. It's modern warfare. It's truly the beginning of modern warfare. I know there were other battles that the ships have, but I'd say this battle of ours and then the Japanese battle at Tsushima Straits. I mean, those are the defining guerre de corps, just like the old days of the British versus the French, only now with modern ships, where it's now ships against ships to win a war for your country. It's not just protecting your country. It's going away, right? Getting them on open oceans and things like that, chasing them down. So what would you expect? What happened is logical. Battleships. Mm-hmm. That's what we need, battleships. Bigger and bigger and bigger and better.
And you can't wait for the war to build them. You have to have them ready when the war takes place, because you can't just pull them out of thin air.
Well, that's true. I think of that a little bit because of my airplane experience, that it takes a while to get an airplane ready for combat. It takes a couple of years, and ships take longer than that. I would say probably 3 or 4 years, and it's all kinds of government changes and scientific changes while you're building it. That's the thing. And you're getting bigger guns, particularly during this period of time, and bigger ships. Just a little bit of tonnage here. I think that the first ones were less than 10,000 tons. They were probably about 6,000, 8,000, something like that. And then they started getting into the 12,000 and 14,000 tons. The aircraft carrier that I was on was the Wasp. It was 18,000 tons, okay? The Dwight Eisenhower was 100,000 tons. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. From World War II to the 1980s, from 18,000 tons to 100,000 tons. That takes a lot of engineering, a lot of fortitude, and a lot of money. The price of them is just ridiculous if you look at the price of the modern ships. So Congress is the one that has the purse strings, and you have to convince Congress that that's really what you need to do and what you have to have to protect the country or project power. And this is when the argument is the Mahanian argument that whoever controls the sea wins. That's it.
And they seem to be much more amenable to that. The Congress of the early 20th century, they seem much more amenable to that than their predecessors from 20, 30 years previously.
Well, that's why I was in Maine looking at Thomas Reed, because he hated battleships. Now, trying to think about, well, what's the alternative? What is the Speaker of the long-term Speaker of the House, you know, a very famous guy, and he doesn't want battleships. And a couple of the earlier Secretary of the Navy didn't like battleships either, but I'm thinking that, you know, after this Spanish-American War, so re-quit. You know, he just resigned from office and stopped doing it. We started, continued building battleships. And I was just interested to find out why did he... I don't think that Thomas Reed thought of the United States being alone. I mean, he certainly was a kind of a guy who believed in the international business and all that sort of stuff. And international business, to me, seems to go with international defense or offense, whatever you're going to call it, you know, whether it's protecting. But we now have ships that are faster than the commercial ships, and I can shoot them at a longer range. So sometimes Roosevelt gets a lot of credit for this, but I think that I see it, McKinley. I'm not too sure about Long, because he was an administrative guy and everything else, but they worked together. They certainly accomplished a lot, whether the impetus was McKinley, who tended to be conservative, yet he certainly had a big Navy, and Long, who tended to be out of office. How did that happen? How did he get such a big Navy with all those guys who don't seem to be the big decision makers, but obviously they must be. I like McKinley a lot. I think he was just a quiet guy and got things done. You know, he wasn't as noisy as Harrison, but Harrison started it, as far as I'm concerned. McKinley, I wouldn't say finished it, but he is really the beginning of the new era and the end of the old one, to me, after the Spanish-American War. Mm-hmm. So then what do? You build ships. Then you look around and then try to get involved in other people's problems, and that's what Roosevelt does. You know, after the assassination, he takes over and he has a vision. You know, and he writes to Mahan and he writes to everybody else and thinks about what's going to happen, and he has kind of his world vision. And I think that the Russo-Japanese War really is significant for us during this period. Mm-hmm. Because these are two countries that are strange. You know, we've never been to war with Russia. The West Coast is worrying about Japanese, and all of a sudden the Japanese win. It's a holy cow. Now what do we do? Right? Yeah. Well, you know what we do. We build more ships, right?
We really don't stop building ships till after World War One, when you have the Washington Treaty, which sets limits on the battleships. Basically, once we start, it takes sort of a mutual... you know, agreement to stand down before we, you know, halt that construction of all those major battleships.
Well, let me tell you a secret here. I'm almost embarrassed to mention this. I originally ended the book in 1917 in the war, and when I sent it to the editors and everything else, and I have my own personal editor, and they all said, I think you need to add a little bit. I think you should go to the Washington Conference, because everybody's going to read this book. And then what happened? Come on, what happened, Paul? Tell them what happened. And I said, you know, here I'm stuck with all my legislative stuff, and I have this whole point I'm going to make. And I said, you know, you're absolutely right. It has to have an end point. That's why I did it. And it was not a bit of a problem, but I realized that I absolutely needed 1921 to end it, because that's what happened, you know. It was a stand down, and a political stand down, and that becomes an argument, you know, during the Franklin Roosevelt investigation. Because remember that during the 1920, Franklin Roosevelt was Assistant Secretary of the Navy, so he was very well involved in that. And I don't see that those guys agreeing with the conference in 1921, but that had a lot to do with post war. And you know, you look at it and say, gee, we don't want to do that anymore. We want to be nice and all that sort of stuff. And it was a mistake for us, because we didn't follow up. You know, we saw it. We ended up by not having the right fleet, but we reacted so well World War II, which is a whole other story. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that stand down was something. And if you really look at the number of the tonnage that we destroyed after 1921, it's really remarkable how much money stopped them and just disarmed them. And we never finished. We never did build a battle cruiser. The first battle cruiser that we had, I think Britain had about four of them, and I know the Gaspé was, Germany had one. Are you familiar what a battle cruiser is. I don't know if I explained it very well in the book or not.
You don't explain it because, as you point out, the U.S. doesn't have them. Basically, battle cruisers have the firepower of a battleship and the speed, but they're much less well-armored, so they can be slightly faster and be deployable more quickly.
And they're bigger. That's the thing. It's a battle cruiser that's bigger, more people, more guns, less armor, and higher speed. Okay. We had some, and one of them became the first aircraft carrier. It was, that's after my book. It was still, it was in the yard, you know, it was halfway finished, and then in the 1920s, they decided to bring this battle cruiser out and put the flight deck on top of it. So our first aircraft carrier was, in fact, built on a battle cruiser hull. I don't remember the name of it or anything, but...
Lexington, the Saratoga.
It was one of those. Was it a battle cruiser hull?
Both of them were built on the battle cruiser hulls.
Okay. I said, see, I stopped thinking in 1921. That's the end of my thought process.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, all right. You really want to know?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, only what you're willing to share.
I have a project now at the Brazoria County Historical Museum to work on a display about post-Civil War convict leasing. How about that?
That sounds fascinating.
And it's a story about how Texas recovered from the Civil War by turning slaves into convicts. And they got the free labor from the prison instead of the free labor from slavery. How's that for a project?
Is it just going to be a presentation, or are you looking to publish
it? No, it's not a book. It's a display.
Okay.
Which is, the director is telling me what he wants, and... He's like, you want a panel, and when he introduced a panel, no more than four sentences and no more than five pictures on the panel and all this stuff. And I said, I just wrote a book that was 300 pages. And I've got to tell you everything in four sentences? That's the difference between museum science and history, I guess. So that's a struggle, but it's a fascinating struggle. It really is, because I'm learning. I'm familiar with the era, of course, but a new skill for an old man, convict leasing, which is pretty ugly. And being south of Houston, it's pretty sensitive because Sugarland was named after the Imperial Sugar Company, and they became millionaires because of convict labor. Billionaires because of convict labor. So Imperial Sugar is the poster boy for convict labor. So that's a interesting subject. So when they asked me to do it, I said, "Wow, why me?" but I think it'll be all right. It's a total difference in the research. As you know, as a historian, how do you do research, and what do you do research for, and how do you choose your sources? And in the Navy case, I was not prepared to go into the depths of Congress that I thought I would. And when I opened the discussion with you, there I am, sitting at a bar with my beer, thinking that. What's going on in the revelation? Congress did it. Now, how long did it take me to get that conclusion after all that research? Because, typically you look at the guys, you look at the war, you look at the Spanish-American War, you look at World War I, and then you see the heroes, and you see all that sort of stuff. And then to come to a conclusion that Congress did it, a couple of my critics would say, Congress always did it. That's not new. I'm sorry. But is that true? Congress always does it, so it's nothing new.
It's just you like the linear narrative that a focus upon the executive, that one person making decisions, so often provides.
Yeah. And of course, what do we do now? And this is one of the reviews that I had last week talked about the Trump administration as if I'm supposed to give advice on the Trump administration, what they're going to do. And I told the guy who asked me this, I said, the future is, as I mentioned before, the future is very hard to predict, as Yogi Berra said, because it hasn't happened yet. and a historian, what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to be figuring it out. And I can tell you this from my experience and my, so we don't always get it right. we see that we entered in World War One, and we see what Wilson is trying to do. He wants to keep us out. And boy, there's mixed reviews on that. We eventually helped a lot, and we only lost 170,000 men as opposed to the millions that the other countries lost. So it was good. But what we didn't need is battleships. I don't think we used them at all. I know they were underway. We used them for escorts or something like that. So here the war breaks out, and we don't know how to shoot to kill a submarine. So we have to buy 500-something sub-chasers. Oh, by the way, I did write a blog for the Naval Institute about sub-chasers at the end of the war. I don't know if you care to track it down or not. Just a short blog, but they asked me to do that kind of as a postscript to the book. And I tried to be nice and say, yeah, we entered the war with battleships, and we really needed sub-chasers. So what happens in my wars? We have all the battleships now come into World War II, and what do we need is aircraft carriers. So now we have aircraft carriers, and what's the next step? Boy, it beats me. You know, is it going to be submarines and aircrafts? Is it going to be missiles? You know, that sort of stuff. And I'm not saying we always get it wrong, but it's hard to predict the future because it hasn't happened yet. I just love that. Yeah,
definitely. Well, Paul, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us about your book, and I hope you have a wonderful day.
And I hope you don't mind my Southern Texas accent.
Not at all.
You notice that. And I'm glad you said that you were from UT, because if you said you were from A&M, I would have said, well, I won't use big words.
Have a good day.